As developers, we are good at envisioning the future state of any given system we want to build. But are we as good at telling the business how those changes positively impact the bottom line? I talked to Lyndon Hederle about a framework he's developed for making arguments just like these on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am your host, Tim Berglund, and I am joined in the virtual studio, again, reaching across the Atlantic Ocean to speak to one of my colleagues in the United Kingdom today. That is Lyndon Hederle. Lyndon, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here.
Now, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, as I always do. I always like to hear just a little bit of background on what you do. I mean, I know what you do, but nobody else does, or nobody else may. And I like to hear background on how you got there. But first, let me kind of frame what we're talking about today. This is, so everyone knows, what I would describe as a rather more businessy discussion. We're going to be talking about business value and how to establish business value and cost effectiveness of some of the technologies we're excited about. Like, how do you make an argument for the value of an event streaming platform? Or how do you think about the cost effectiveness of one cloud service versus another? And this is really important stuff. Even if what you do is, you know, your job is to be a full-time developer and you're not in a leadership position to make financial arguments for why one thing ought to be done rather than another, these kinds of thoughts are a fundamental part of the engineering discipline. Engineers are always optimizing for cost. And if you're working for a business, you always have to be able to speak in terms of the business value of things. So this is really important material, and I'm excited to be talking about it. And I think just in terms of our knowledge portfolio as developers and architects, this is probably a neglected topic for us. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have it on the show. I think it's really important. So with that, pay attention and listen. And I'm excited to learn, Lyndon, from you. But before we do that, tell us about yourself.
Okay. I've been working in the enterprise software field for just over 20 years. So I joined that after university. I joined Anderson Consulting, which is now Accenture, but back then it was a consulting firm, and did that traditional career path of learning to code and test on large enterprise, custom-built, mostly finance systems, actually. So a kind of deep dive, steep learning curve in enterprise software, and moved through Accenture. Always found the strategy more interesting than the deep technology. So whilst I had a bit of a technology background, I moved into the strategy practice and spent 13 years in Accenture, actually, learning about how to drive value out of technology investments mostly. And then left and joined a little startup in the UK. I was on the founding team of that startup. 5 years there, then left and joined a US startup 3 years, and then joined Confluent 2.5, getting on for 3 years ago. And at Confluent, I head up the business value consulting team.
Awesome. So tell us about your approach here. Like, why? I kind of gave a little bit of a preview of why I think it's important and how I think this is fundamental to engineering, is trading off cost. But give us some background on where you're coming from when you talk about cost effectiveness.
Yeah, so it's when we talk business value, you can usually boil it down to three things. And this may be something to justify any technology investment, but it's really any investment at all, or any business, really. So a business is ultimately about making money. If it's not making money, it's not really a business, but it's really about making money. And then within a business, you're often looking at working with money in the most efficient way. So saving money and or protecting money, or sometimes looking at new ways of making money, so new business models. And so it's really those three things: making money, making more money, making new money, or saving or protecting money. And And when you look at any investment, you should be able to draw back that investment as to how it's contributing to one or more of those things. So
protecting money would be mitigating risk of some kind, right? Like some bad thing might happen and you want to make it less likely.
Exactly. So as an example, if you were to justify the implementation of a fraud detection and prevention system, it's going to cost you money to implement that, but the result might be that you are protecting money. So you may not quantify that value in terms of hard savings, actually, or you certainly wouldn't be making money, but it's protecting the money that you have and protecting sometimes reputation. So non-quantifiable elements as well.
Gotcha. Good that there are non-quantifiable things in there. Because, you know, I guess the fantasy of risk mitigation is, you know, this, we will incur cost X with probability P, and this investment reduces P to this number. And, you know, so you got your expected value and everything lines up and we're wonderful utility maximizing people and we make the investment or we don't. But it's not always that clear cut.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of the undertaking business value assessments, actually, is that you want it to be as scientific and as empirical as possible. By empirical, we mean kind of based on observation and fact and hard numbers. And to some extent, we can get there, but that's only half the journey, really. There's another half, which is about unquantifiable soft benefits or intangibles, depending on what you want to call it. But with the fraud detection system we just talked about, as an example, that if you are protecting reputation, what is the value of that? It's very hard to put a dollar figure on it, but it can have huge value. It can actually be equivalent value to the whole business potentially. If you're faced with a catastrophic hack, for example. So it gets interesting. It's kind of science and art.
Absolutely. So I think those concepts are clear, and most of us who are technical people, who have grown up as technical people and haven't spent a decade plus at Anderson come Accenture, you know, really drilling down into this, I think a lot of us run out of gas. Everything you said makes sense. There's the quantifiable stuff, which is great when you can actually do that. There's the intangible stuff where, you know, you're not making a strict comparison of numbers, but you're just applying wisdom and judgment and things like that. That all makes sense, but where do we go from there? You've developed a framework, and I want our listeners to learn a little bit about that. Obviously, we only have 45 minutes to talk here today, so this will be but a taste of a white paper that is to come, folks. But tell us about the framework.
So the first step, when we talk to customers, they are often on the event streaming or Kafka journey already, and we are sometimes justifying an investment in Confluent. So why Confluent Platform or why Confluent Cloud, or maybe a combination of the two with a comparison. But before we get there, sometimes we are talking to customers to justify the journey to go on to event streaming. So it's really why Kafka or why event streaming. And the approach we take is slightly different for the two. So in the first step, the why Kafka or why event streaming, we can look at an ROI, return on investment justification in that. So we might look at a specific solution. It might be to improve customer experience, to reduce operational costs, to mitigate risk of fraud system, as an example. And that is step one of the process. Now, we are often talking to customers that have been through that, and we're just looking at why Confluent, why invest in Confluent. For both cases, though, we go through a five-step framework, and this is really quite simple. We look at the baseline, so what's the current scenario or situation or costs of doing nothing, if you like, and that we might be looking at the revenue projections over the next 3 years or operational costs over the next 3 years or a combination of the two. But we'd want to have a baseline, which is something to compare against. It's almost like in a science experiment, you have a control group, and we need that to compare the thing we're going to test, which is the event streaming use case, the solution that we're putting in, or the Confluent platform, or the Confluent Cloud, or the thing we want to test. And we would look at the projections of costs in that scenario, step two. Then step three, we look at the benefits, which is the kind of step two minus step one, if you like. So isolating that dependent variable, the thing we're trying to test, and look at gross benefits with that, and then net benefits. So the net benefits being the benefits minus the project costs to achieve those benefits. And then step four of five is looking at the soft benefits, the intangibles, the things that are harder to quantify. And finally, in step five, we look for proof points or examples that we can show where these benefits have been realized in real life. So it provides a bit of kind of corroborating evidence, if you like, that we can realize these benefits. So it's five steps. We go through that, and we try and work with customers to ensure they are buying into these estimates and assumptions that we work throughout that process.
Awesome. Okay. Now I want you to one sentence or top level summary kind of thing each. Relist those five steps so everybody's got that fresh in their mind. So step one.
Yeah. So step one is the baseline. So the do nothing. And step two is the target state. So the thing we're trying to test. It may be the event streaming use case, or it may be the Confluent platform or Confluent Cloud. Step three is the quantified benefits of comparing step one and step two. And step four is the unquantified or soft or intangible benefits of comparing step one and step two. And then finally, step five is the proof points that you can realize those benefits.
Love it. Love it. So kind of walk us through that. Let me frame it this way. There's a conversation I have frequently when I am at conferences or meetups. We're of course recording this during the middle of a pandemic where there is no such thing. But back in the days when I could go and talk to people in person, and you know, I'll give a talk on event streaming architectures or an introduction to Kafka or something like that, a common hallway track conversation that I will have after that is with somebody saying, I want to do this in my organization. I'm not sure how to make the case because it's new and scary and nobody knows how to do it. You know, those developers with a real professional intuition that this is the thing to do and this is the way the world is going, but I don't know how to make the case. So walk us through that with this five-step framework for the event streaming, you know, kind of the let's go to Kafka and an event-driven architecture.
Yeah, sure. Kind of thing. I'll give you a real-world example. So I worked with a bank that wanted to introduce event streaming. They saw it as strategic and potentially the most strategic data platform for their business in the next 5 years, but they weren't yet on that journey, and they wanted the first one or two use cases to justify the initial investment to start the event streaming adoption. And we worked with them to look at various use cases. As you know, event streaming can be used for many different things, whether it's regulatory reporting through to customer experience, front ends, kind of mobile phone notifications, and so on. But in this case, we identified a single use case. It was an interesting one for a retail bank, and they found that one of their processes that caused difficulty and complexity and cost in the organization was around ATM disputes. So this is when people were going to an ATM machine and withdrawing money and for some reason raising a dispute. So either the machine was dispensing the wrong amount of money or no money, or they were depositing money and it wasn't credited to their account. And sometimes this was within their bank or other banks in the network. So there were lots of different issues. It turns out it was costing that bank it was somewhere between $80 and $100 to resolve an ATM dispute. They had call center staff dedicated to this. They were losing a significant amount of money each month in the process of resolving disputes. Often the disputes were for much less than the cost to resolve them. But it was a complex, time-consuming, lengthy process to resolve the disputes. They looked, so that's the target state, sorry, the current state. So step one, through a process of discovery conversations, we collected the costs associated with this use case, if you like. So, and we then looked at a target state where the target state involved implementing an event streaming platform to stream all the different data sources that a customer agent would go through in resolving a dispute. And this could be logs from ATM machines. It could be contextual information around the customer, their bank account details, and all sorts of flow of information could go through an event streaming platform to speed up the resolution of those ATM disputes. And we, in the target state, we estimated that we could resolve ATM disputes in 25% of the time and cost, and we could reduce the number of ATM disputes that would sometimes receive payouts just because the process was quite complex. So we had a baseline and we forecast costs over 3 years. We had a target state, we forecast costs over 3 years, which showed a significant reduction in costs. And then we looked at the cost to implement that. Sorry.
And then the quantified benefits, are we now at step three when you say that with the event streaming solution in place, we should be at 25% of the resolution cost?
Exactly.
That's step three. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Nice. And then we can look at the cost to implement that solution to get the net benefits. So the total benefits minus the cost to implement and run the event streaming platform. And in this example, we put a very convincing case together to effectively a business case to justify the investment in an event streaming platform.
Right. Because you have the cost of the null hypothesis, as it were, the status quo. You've got really an estimated cost, and a cost savings of the event streaming implementation. Now, I know you're not done yet. We're only on step three. We have intangible benefits and proof points yet to go, but I want to drill into some of this here, because I think this is where it gets interesting. Step two, by the way, describing the target state. That's where every developer and architect in the world goes, right? That's what we're good at. That's what we're excited about. That's a fun thing to talk about. I can build prototypes. I can make slide decks, whatever my thing is. But that's where we want to live. And so I feel like we have that down. It's good that has a place in the process, because that's the thing that we love. In this case, how did you get the cost estimate? Because you know what it costs now. You can imagine what the event streaming system will be, and you're saying we're going to save 75% per incident. How do you justify that?
So there's different approaches we can take, and we tend to work with the customer to ensure they're comfortable with whichever process we can take. So at the basic level, you can do a high-level guesstimate. You know, we know today it takes, let's say, 4 to 8 days for a single agent to resolve an ATM dispute. And we know all the information sources they go to, and some of that requires kind of request response, and there's delays on that data coming and so on. So we can make a guess that if that data is readily available, the agent can resolve in, let's say, 25% of the time. So it's instead of 4 days, it's 1 day. We can actually go a step further, though, and do a proof of concept on that. So we can mock up data that agent would go to, the source data to resolve a dispute, and make it readily available and see how long it takes them, and kind of prove to some extent that it takes 1 day instead of four. Now, that's not always possible to do in the different use cases we look at. Other ways is to look at what other organizations have done. So when we introduce a system to improve customer experience, for example, we can go to industry standard data that says, you know, like maybe the analysts, Gartner, Forrester, if you improve customer experience by X, you tend to see a benefit of Y. And you can lean on some of those data sources to get general kind of buy-in to your estimates and assumptions.
Got it. That makes sense. And I guess you're going to do a proof of concept for bigger investments. If there's more money on the table, then that justifies spending the engineering time on the proof of concept to just gain more confidence about your estimate.
Yeah, and we often talk about proof of concepts to prove the technology, or, you know, prove the integration that we can, I don't know, offload off a mainframe and so on.
But
a proof of concept can also be a value proof of, I mean, we sometimes refer to it as a proof of value, actually. So you're proving technically that it works, but that the value is going to be delivered as well.
That makes sense. And the another thing I wanted to just highlight is the in the proof of concept case, you said use build a mock-up presenting, in this case, the actual agents, customer service agents who are going to be doing the resolution with, you know, they already know what their current system looks like. Here is a fake version of screens that you'd be looking at if it was all in one place, like our event streaming system is going to be able to do for you. And presumably you build that with historical data or something that you had on hand to make it realistic and kind of run that test in a fairly scientific way.
Yeah, exactly. And other use cases might have known data volumes. So for example, we have done business value assessments around mainframe offload. So we can literally, we know very much in that baseline current state exactly how many API calls, for example, are hitting a mainframe. We know what that costs in terms of MIPS costs on a mainframe, and we know exactly by reducing those costs, i.e. reducing the traffic through the mainframe, making reads from an event streaming platform, for example. So in some scenarios, we can be very factual around what the cost savings are going to be. In others, where we're talking about implementing a customer experience initiative for faster, better notifications, for example, it can become a little bit more nebulous. What is the business value of a better customer experience? It's sometimes hard to quantify that, and so we tend to see different scenarios across the when we're talking business use cases or why event streaming is. It tends to be quite specific, and which is also why it's kind of hard to productize this in terms of a business value assessment. It tends to be a customized, bespoke activity each time.
Very much, which is why it takes someone with some experience doing this in lots of different scenarios to be able to figure out how to attack it. That's my way of saying it. This is why we have Lindens, and because it's not obvious, but these things, as you're describing them, seem very obvious. And yeah, mainframe offload is clearly the fantasy business value justification scenario. You know, there's a transaction cost, and by transaction cost, I mean this is how much an API call costs, and then you perform a multiplication, and then you know you're done. So I like that one better than the other ones.
Yeah, it's always much easier to show cost savings in a business case than it is to show revenue enhancement, and that's always the case. Making money or making new money is always a bit more of a leap of faith, but cost savings typically tend to be a little bit more concrete.
Absolutely. Leap of faith also, you said estimate the cost to implement is a part of the quantified benefits comparison step three. And of course, we all know, I mean, estimate with a capital E there, that's tricky as well.
Yeah, and there's a number of different categories of costs that we would want to estimate in terms of the total costs. So some costs, like the Confluent subscription costs and Confluent professional services, we can estimate and with some level of confidence that these are going to be your initial investment and then ongoing operational costs.
Totally, that's the easy part.
Yeah, but we want to make sure this is a true, honest, totally transparent kind of reflection of all costs. So we'd want to understand the customer costs, potentially systems integrator or partner costs, and then maybe other hidden costs. So that tends to be these exercises really need to be a true partnership with the customer to arrive at all this.
Sure. I guess what I'm getting at is people got to write code in there, and that's notoriously difficult to estimate within more than a factor of, you know, 3 or 4x, right? You don't always get that right.
Yeah, exactly. And it's useful actually when you go through these exercises to try and model a range. So what does best case look like, but what does worst case look like? So if you overrun on project costs, but also what if the benefits aren't quite as great as you thought they were going to be, or what happens if they're better actually? And you can model a range and show a worst case scenario, a best case scenario, and then somewhere a conservative in the middle is usually how how we approach that.
Sure, sure. Unknowns, there are error bars on all those things, for sure. And I guess the point is you want there to be enough margin in the design, as it were, to have it not have been an irrational thing if your most optimistic value estimate and least optimistic cost estimate don't line up.
Yeah, I always make a point of the business case. We want it to be as honest and transparent as possible, because it's not really within anyone's interest to create a business case that's erroneous or flawed assumptions or wildly exaggerated. That may have been true back in the day when technology investments involved a kind of upfront software sale with maybe some ongoing maintenance. But these days, though, most projects involve ongoing subscription costs. And as part of that, we want to show ongoing value. And without doing that, you're dead in the water on renewals of subscription. So it's not within anyone's interest to wildly exaggerate an overall project or kind of platform justification.
Exactly. It really, really isn't. And that statement is true. You don't want to embark on a new technology project that is not going to help the business be more profitable. You just don't want that. And I occasionally tell people this, like the question in a developer audience, the question takes the form of, when is Kafka the wrong thing? That's kind of the way people will ask that question. And I'll usually say, well, if you've got a system that is performing the way it's supposed to, and it's relatively easy for you to evolve it over time, and there's no, performance pressure on it where it's not working well enough, it's not performing well enough, customers like it, the business likes it and everything, you probably don't need to go rethinking your whole approach to software architecture. Like, keep doing the thing that you're doing. If it's a monolith centered on a database and not an event streaming system, but everybody's happy with it, well, then it's a good thing. Like, don't change that thing. Now, and so the purely business utility maximizer, decision maker, advocate kind of person would look at that scenario and say, that's right. I'm not gonna argue for event streaming. I'm not gonna try to get this project accepted. I'm not gonna try to get us all moved to Kafka. It's kind of how that perfectly rational actor would think. What's interesting is, and this is probably a topic that is slightly off of our topic, but it's worth talking about, because people want to get things done at work. They want in business certain projects to be undertaken. And I'm not convinced everybody's motivation is always, here's how we make money, here's how we save money, here's how we protect money. I want to make more money, I want to save more money, I want to protect more money. I feel like the motivations people have, particularly for large technology megatrends like Kafka and like event streaming, the people who are in a position to influence an organization's choice of large architectural direction, like we're going to go to event streaming, that's a huge architectural direction change. I don't think the things that motivate that thinker are make money, save money, protect money, which is where this gets interesting, right? So you have people making arguments and thinking, well, I want to do this. Let me try to figure out how we can make more money or where the cost saving is. But the motivation, the drive to do that thing is already in place for some, we'll just say, unexamined reason. What do you think about that?
Yeah, this is interesting. And a lot of Kafka implementations or event streaming implementations are made without a business case. And actually that is fine. It's I think in these circumstances, the developers or engineers, the technical team inherently understand the value of Kafka. So they don't have to sit back and quantify that. And they understand it in terms of it makes their lives easier, right? They can do more in less time, they can scale and work with data in ways that they couldn't previously. Or there were challenges previously around I don't know, breaking systems or the expense of scaling out servers or waiting for the batch processors to run. So it's okay to not go through a business case in that scenario. I think where it gets interesting, though, is in the adoption of event streaming. We typically see this curve of you know, step one to two, up through to five, actually coincidentally the same my five-step framework for assessing business value. But these are slightly different steps of maturity where as the adoption of event streaming platform becomes more strategic in a business, you tend to get more resources thrown at it. It's running mission-critical systems. It's got C-suite visibility. And all of a sudden, you need budget. You need to hire more people. And you probably want some of the features and functions in Confluent Platform or Confluent Cloud as a fully managed service that you didn't have previously. I.e., you need to request budget. And to request budget, the senior management often want to see a justification for that in a business case. So yes, whilst it's okay to not always think about making money, saving money, protecting money, I think inherently this group is probably actually thinking about saving money because they're thinking about doing more with less. But there becomes a point in the adoption that you probably have to kind of put that down on paper. And then it's a slight flip in the way of thinking from the technology benefits to business benefits. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it does. It does. And I don't mishear me. It's absolutely essential that that argument be made. You know, that's these tools that you're giving us are the tools that we can use to actually make technology change happen in the enterprise. So the people with the purse strings, of course, everybody's a person, has their own complex set of motivations, and you know, they're usually less obviously utility maximizing in the strict sense than we'd like to think they are. And you know, there's the complex politics of the decision makers in any organization. But there's a point at which, when you're trying to get a substantial technology investment made in any sort of business that anybody listening to this podcast is going to be working for, the decision makers are probably going to be applying some sort of fairly responsible discipline that aligns well with your five-step framework. In other words, you know, your five steps that you've taken us through and that sort of hat trick of make money, save money, protect money, you need to articulate it in those terms. It's interesting, I think, that when it starts as a grassroots thing, I think there are very few technologists who start thinking that way. And that's why I said at the beginning, hey, everybody listen up, you need this, because you know, we have our incentives and our motivations, which, Lyndon, frankly, as you know, it's the new shiny. It's a new thing that is not like the thing I was doing 5 years ago. And, you know, I talked to my friends at a conference last year who are doing it and it sounded cool and I want to do it. I mean, that's I think a lot more of software architect thinking sounds like that kind of in the heart than we'd be willing to admit. And we now have to go through this process of translating those sort of real motivations that we have into a credible and honest business case. And I think that's why the question comes up of how do I convince my company to do this thing? You know, this perennial developer question of, I know this is the right thing to do, but I can't get the business to do it. And this framework is the answer. Yeah. You know, yeah. Whatever your reasons are, they're great. You need to be able to express it in these terms.
Yeah, and the magic happens with event streaming platforms, I think, in when that bottom up adoption, where the technologists have implemented the technology, kind of meets the top down strategic in understanding really of what the power of event streaming, and that really happens where you start to mix multiple use cases. So you get this platform network effect, or Metcalfe's law, which states that the more people in a network, the more valuable it becomes, which is partly what drives the value of Facebook or even telephones. You know, it's not very valuable if two or three people have a telephone in a population, but if everyone has a telephone, it becomes invaluable. And actually, an event streaming platform in a business is similar. The more publishers to the platform, the more subscribers, which in turn writes more publishing, and it's a virtuous cycle. So to drive that benefit, though, you really need to start talking to get that top-down awareness and the adoption, and that conversation is a business value conversation. It's not really a technology features and functions conversation. So that's the interesting element of a platform play in a business, and where the business value becomes so important.
Indeed. Now, if I'm keeping track correctly, Lyndon, you only got us through step three of the streaming platform adoption. You were, I think, trying gently to segue us into talking about cloud, and I'm going to let you do that in a minute, but I don't think I've given you a chance to express intangible benefits or proof points in your example of the ATM thing. And if you did, and I just lost them in the conversation, forgive me, but hit those up if you could.
Yeah, sure. The so the intangibles get interesting. There's many, actually, with that specific use case example. So this bank assumed that some people were just trying it on ATM disputes. They would make a claim and see if they could get their $20 or $30 kind of refunded. And with a much better process where you could demonstrate clearly through the call center that you had data available, that you knew exactly when the transaction was, when it took place, whether the bank account was deducted or not. The data flows that were taking days or weeks to access previously, you start to not only result in real-term cost savings in the reduction of time to resolve the cases, but also you give people a much better customer experience. They tend to have more trust in the bank, more loyalty. They're more likely to become repeat customers versus the opposite, where a customer feels hard done by through, you know, potential ATM dispute. If you can resolve that within a day instead of weeks, you're driving customer experience, and that has an intangible value that's hard to quantify. But there are others. That's a good example, though, of something you wouldn't necessarily attempt to quantify. Now you could kind of say maybe there's a better customer, a lesser customer attrition, maybe. But again, it can start to make assumptions that can become difficult to test. So that's step four, and then step five, you try to show scenarios where we've done this previously. Now that specific use case isn't one that I've come across widely, but we can show others, or maybe run a proof of concept, or other examples across similar use cases and data flows and so on. So yeah, that's the overall process.
All right. Now, and by the way, that was extremely helpful. Thank you. Next step is, you said also cost justification for, you said Confluent Cloud, and as you're writing white papers and everything, obviously you're writing this from a Confluent perspective. So this is all how to make a total cost of ownership argument for Confluent Cloud. It is, of course, more general than that. You need to get into specifics, and those would be the specific costs of the service. But migrating to the cloud is not a particularly controversial decision these days. Anytime it's controversial is really because of data sovereignty or some kind of extremely stringent regulatory concern. In general, people are not worried about the cost, but maybe they should be, right? Because again, another example of a way this question will come to me. You know, no developer walks up to me at a conference and sounds like you, but they might ask something like, "How do I know whether to use?" I'm blanking. I wanted to say Dynamo, Kinesis. Whether I should use Amazon Kinesis or hosted Kafka and Confluent Cloud. Well, there's a lot of technical things that are different between the two, but also that's a cost thing. You know, there isn't like a maximum upper bound cloud scale, practically speaking. Most cloud services are going to scale to where you need them, but scale is cost. And so this TCO question and some more rigorous framework for thinking about TCO means total cost of ownership, listeners, if I'm going too fast there. But some rigorous framework for thinking about that with the cloud would be helpful. So take us through that.
Yeah, so far we've talked mostly about justifying why Kafka or why event streaming. So we'd look at a specific business use case or solution, and we talked about the ATM example, but it could be a mainframe offload project or customer experience initiative or other fraud detection system or one of the many thousands of uses of an event streaming platform. But here, let's say we've completed that step and we are all bought in to the initiative, the project. Now it becomes a question of why Confluent. So that can be why Confluent Platform or why Confluent Cloud or why partner with Confluent at all from a perspective. And here, again, we use the same five-step process. So what does the baseline look like? And that might be going open source Kafka. It might be using Kinesis in your example or other. But what we want to do is ensure that when we look at the cost projections over the next 3 years, that the total costs are considered. So this is all cost categories where implementing Confluent might have an impact. So the challenge of comparing against Kinesis sometimes is people might just look at the single cost category of what is the subscription cost of Kinesis versus the subscription cost of Confluent Cloud and compare those on a like-for-like basis. And of course, they are quite different services. So we would want to also ensure that we're considering effort to set up, effort to operate, to elastically scale up and down, and so on. So the first step really is to ensure we're capturing all the cost categories.
And the next step.
Yeah, and then as a second step, once we've agreed on the cost categories and what they would look like over 3 years, we need to put kind of valid estimates into those. So the main areas that we look at actually are the developer and operator or sometimes DevOps team, so how many in that team and how much they cost as a fully loaded cost. So this is to set up the environment to develop on the project. It can be things like to build out connectors and then ongoing operations costs. And I think we're all familiar with the typical operations costs, but we can model things that may come in through business requests. So it may be scaling up, scaling down, bug fixing, the general like FTE or full-time equivalent costs in that scenario. And we would want to compare the baseline that whether it's setting up and running a Kafka open source cluster on-premise or in a public cloud or setting up a service like MSK. And we would want to chart that and show what it looked like over 3 years. Again, that kind of five-step process. And we'd want absolute buy-in from the customer that baseline is broadly true and correct, and they understand some of the negative consequences of that baseline scenario. So with open source Kafka, for example, it's, you know, not every business wants to, that's not their core focus or core function to set up and operate a Kafka cluster. They've got other things they should be focusing their best people on. With Kinesis,
on a percentage basis, almost no business has that as their core function.
Yeah.
Right. And I work for one, but just about everybody else, it's not really your job.
Yeah. And many businesses have evolved to a scenario situation where they have a few different teams that have ended up kind of running Kafka clusters. And you have to kind of stop and ask, is this what you want to be doing? And is it the best possible solution for you? So you can look at that and list not only the costs, but we will look at cost takeout and with the target state. But it's important to look at other areas. So cost takeout is one. And another area, maybe if the environment's been set up, is the time it takes to do that. So the time to market. So and the third is some of those intangibles that we talked about. So if let's say a business decides to create their own Kafka cluster, whether it's an open source or public cloud, or they've decided to set up a service such as MSK, they typically will still need to dedicate resources to that. And what is the business value, let's say, of taking those resources out and enabling them to refocus on core business functionality? That there is clearly cost saving there, and albeit you're not going to fire those people, you're not going to start paying them less. They will still get paid their salary. So that cost saving is an indirect saving. It's a redirection of effort, and you'd expect that redirection to be on something that's a higher business value to the business. So maybe a core business, maybe it's building out some of the use case functionality that differentiates that business.
To be clear, the person making the argument here, the here's why we should use Confluent Cloud justification, isn't on the hook for identifying the new investment to make with those resources, right? You're basically just saying, well, you know, there are four FTEs that we won't need. And, you know, what do we do with them? I don't know. You guys are managers, you figure it out. I mean, that's implicitly the message of the justification, right?
Yeah. And usually when you're talking to a budget holder, I mean, it's an interesting point actually, because sometimes you will see some protectionism of someone thinking, well, actually I've got a team and I don't know what to do with them if I don't have this scenario. Now that's rare, but you do sometimes see it. Although working with that person, if you kind of sometimes like educate them on what they could do outside of running the Kafka cluster, most people will accept that doing more with less is a good thing, right? And certainly budget holders will always accept that doing more with less is a good thing. So the point though is that cost takeout is only one reason to move to a simpler structure, be it the Confluent platform or a fully managed service in Confluent Cloud. There are other considerations, which are potentially higher value considerations around time to market, agility, freeing resources to focus on more like high value business elements, and kind of general security around your resilience of your platform that's now measured in kind of managed SLAs versus having an in-house team kind of running that. So there are many business areas to pick, not just cost takeout.
Excellent. And good reminder there that for any given decision maker, the utilities they're maximizing, again, may not be make money, save money, protect money. It might be, you know, protect status, protect turf, protect empire. There are all kinds of other things that enter the picture that are intentionally not modeled in your framework, but you know, we need to call them out as the sorts of things that we deal with when we're trying to get things done.
Yeah, absolutely. And with cloud arguments, too many arguments are focused on TCO, so cost takeout alone. Actually, though, when you talk to businesses as to why they've chosen a cloud, a fully managed service, often it's a kind of higher level strategic direction. Because it just makes sense. But sometimes you have to really quantify what does it mean when we say because it just makes sense. And cost takeout is a component of that, but the business agility, the time to get this set up and relieving the organization from the operational burden of something that's not core, a kind of core skill, these are all key value features.
And these sound like step four intangible benefits to me.
Yeah, and this is interesting actually, because they are hard to quantify, and again, kind of what. So, you can look at a fully loaded cost of an FTE and say you now no longer need to point that person at Kafka, but probably the real value is much more intangible than that. You now have those FTEs doing core kind of building out core business functionality that might differentiate and grow your business, and then there's elements of in a fully managed service, as we know, we've got SLAs and security elements that that again are kind of hard to quantify the value of. So, what is the cost of downtime if you try and manage this yourself. Some organizations are happy to accept there's a greater risk of downtime if they self-manage. So we have thousands of hours of Kafka expertise, so not and we deliver a service to high-level SLAs. So we believe we have less chance of downtime, but some organizations are happy to model that. They will estimate the cost of their downtime. A retail outlet, for example, maybe runs on an e-commerce site. They can calculate exactly how much revenue is going through the site at any one time, to the point where they can calculate the cost of downtime to the second or minute. Other platforms are more difficult to quantify the cost of downtime, and there may be unquantifiables like reputation damage, service degradation, slowing down developers, all sorts of hidden costs around downtime. Yeah,
workforce is more sad, you know, all true, but they're not quantitative.
We're coming
up against time, which makes me sad because I want to keep talking about this. This has been super interesting and helpful for me. But how, give us kind of a summary of this topic, key takeaways, and really what is it that you want to leave folks with? And again, there's a white paper coming that may even be live by the time this podcast is live. So check the show notes. And so you'll be able to get the full force of Lyndon Hederle and cost effectiveness, but sum it up for us, Lyndon.
Yeah, I think so. The focus for this podcast is on business value. So what do we mean by business value? And it's really trying to boil that down to showing how we can make money, make more money, save money, or protect money. We have a process of doing that in terms of justifying why invest in an event streaming platform or why Kafka. We would look at business case justification around specific solutions or use cases. But in addition, we've got a second step, which would be why Confluent? So once you've justified why event streaming or why Kafka, we can look at why Confluent. It's the same five-step process, but it's slightly different focus on costs, but we shouldn't focus only on cost takeout. There's a higher business value reasons for selecting Confluent around time to value and overall return on investment, and some of those may be intangibles. So that's a quick summary. And as you say, that I am writing a white paper that should be published imminently.
My guest today has been Lyndon Hederle. Lyndon, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tim. And I listened to these. It's great to be a part of it. And just one comment that we do offer a free of charge, no obligation TCO assessment. And that link is available if you do a search for Project Metamorphosis on Confluent and look at the cost effectiveness blog. There should be a link to the TCO offer there. But thanks again.
Hey, you know what you get for listening to the end? Some free Confluent Cloud. Use the promo code 60PDCAST, that's 60PDCAST, to get an additional $60 of free Confluent Cloud usage. Be sure to activate it by December 31st, 2021, and use it within 90 days after activation. And any unused promo value on the expiration date will be forfeit, and there are a limited number of codes available, so don't miss out. Anyway, as always, I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in our community Slack. There's a Slack signup link in the show notes if you'd like to join. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover us, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.